Case of Bray versus the Commonwealth?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Berger, how you doing?
Morning. Ronald Bray.
Do you care to reserve some time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
3 minutes, yes, sir.
Ronald Bray made friends with an undercover officer and sold him moonshine. Unfortunately, Mr. Bray, he invited the moonshiner into his house where he kept his old .22 that he used to shoot animals that got to his chickens, and it was within 100 yards as crow flies from where he stored his moonshine. So he got charged with 3 felonies for selling moonshine. We are here today related to a double jeopardy argument. I would like to suggest that double jeopardy is not an island of law all by itself, but that it plays a very important role in due process, equal protection, and fundamental fairness, in that double jeopardy is a protection that protects us from being punished multiple times for what we do.
Mr. Berger, let me see if we can simplify this. You've raised 2 approaches to this on appeal. One is the statutory violation of 19.2294. Can we agree that that statute only applies to subsequent prosecutions?
I can agree that the courts have said that.
Well,
I can also,
we're kind of bound by that, aren't we?
Well, I think the courts can change their mind. If you go back to old cases on this code section, they have changed their mind. Earlier, this code section actually came about as a result of a moonshine conviction. That's the history.
Well, I mean, the plain language of the statute says that, you know, conviction under one statute or ordinance bars prosecution or proceeding under another. I mean, I don't know how you interpret that any other way than it doesn't apply to simultaneous prosecutions.
Well, it was not previously interpreted that way. I will concede I cannot convince you of that here today.
Okay.
And I will concede because the courts have said that. I think that a literal interpretation of the statute can be construed that, and dissents by the Virginia Supreme Court have agreed with my argument, but they are dissents.
That'd be your next stop then.
Well, yes, sir, and then only but when they become the majority, but I will keep making the argument until the dissenters I expire, or the dissenters no longer exist.
My money's on you, Mr. Berger.
Thank you.
Let's turn them to the block.
My more substantive argument with a greater possibility of success here today is the double jeopardy.
Well, let's turn to that then, the Blockburger test, which you know, you seem to be suggesting that the same conduct can't be subject to prosecution under more than one similar statute. Is that the thrust of your argument?
Can I answer the question in a non-yes or no answer? I would say it is the thrust of my argument, but with a bit more definition to it than that. I submit that the question is the legislative intent, and that it is not just a black and white Blockburger test, but it is the legislative intent. Did the legislature intend for a person to be punished twice for this behavior? And was that their intent? For instance, is it the legislative intent that we be prosecuted for grand larceny and petit larceny?
Well, see, the way I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, but the body of law that relates, first of all, the same conduct test was adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court back in the 90s in Grady versus Corbin, and then overruled 5 years later. So that's why I asked the question. I want to make sure. And while the Blockburger test has come and gone and come again, I guess, in terms of its applicability to double jeopardy issues, it remains the only available test for determining if the double jeopardy clause has been violated. And it's an abstract application of statutory comparisons.
I would not concede that point, Your Honor. I would submit that this court, in the Holley case, decided in 2014, said specifically that, and quoting from this court, which quoted from Andrews, which was the Virginia Supreme Court, while Blockburger can provide an efficient mechanism to parse statutory language in order to determine the legislature's intent with regard to whether multiple punishments are permitted for conduct chargeable under more than one code section, it is not the sole, or in many cases, the primary tool of statutory construction used to determine that intent.
That's that homicide case in Portsmouth? Judge McCullough's opinion? I want to make sure. Anyway, it sounds familiar.
I believe that is where.
Well, and I think the context of that.
They were convicted of felony murder and second degree murder.
Yes.
The court said, no, you can't do that. Even though they're different statutes, even though they're different elements, even though it passes the Blackburger test,
It was our en banc.
It was.
Yes, all right. Thank
you. Now, going back to the Andrew case, which the en banc court followed there, the Andrew case is significant in that it goes on to say, and these cases go back to the Whalen case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, which says that the issue here is legislative intent. And Blackburger is a tool, Blackburger is a way, Blackburger has not been overruled, as I hope it will be, but it is only a tool, and it should be looked at as a tool and not finally determinative. And this court said that it is not determinative because legislative intent is determinative, and we're not going to let Blackburger put blinders on us and be bound by a Blackburger analysis that we don't think is correct. And in Andrews, the court says, as the United States Supreme Court has observed, it would be difficult to contend otherwise without converting what is essentially a factual inquiry as to legislative intent to a conclusive presumption of law, that any differentiation in the language defining the elements of an offense would authorize multiple punishments for otherwise undifferentiated conduct. And it cites Garrett. 471 U.S. 779. Where the same conduct violates two statutory provisions, the first step in the double jeopardy analysis is to determine whether the legislature intended each legislation to be a separate offense. That is the inquiry. And I understand that Blackburger is a stepping stone into that, but it is not the end of the inquiry. And unless I get you off of Blackburger, I will probably concede that I will lose here today, because if you do an actual Blackburger, you can make it. But let me show you how Blackburger is wrong. Grand larceny, I would submit that each of you would say today that petty larceny is a lesser included offense of grand larceny. If I was here arguing for the Attorney General, I would say, no, Your Honor, it's not, because grand larceny of a firearm is grand larceny, even if it has no value. And petty larceny requires value. So under a Blackburger test, grand larceny statute is not a petty larceny, it's not a lesser included offense. Let's take reckless driving. Reckless driving is driving 20 or more with speed limit, or five other different things that you could do, running a red light, running a stop sign, etc. If I am speeding and I am driving 20 miles per hour, can I be convicted of both? Reckless driving by going 21 miles an hour over the speed limit and speeding. I hope not. I hope that our law hasn't evolved to that point that we would be blind to say Blackburger says you can be, and therefore we're not going to take off the Blackburger blinders. I'm asking to take off the Blackburger blinders here today and look at these statutes. Look at what we're talking about. The statutes themselves, and my client wasn't prosecuted with a broadness of saying did manufacture, transport. They said he did sell illegally sell alcohol while he had a gun. Okay? He pled guilty to that. We accept that. Now, the other charge was that he, under section 4.1-302, it says illegal sale of alcoholic beverages in general. That's the name of the statute. Any person who is not licensed sells any alcoholic beverages is guilty of a class 1 misdemeanor. Well, that is a secondary offense that is covered by the unlawful sale in the firearm statute. And the firearm statute says broadly in its title, violations by armed persons penalty. No person shall unlawfully sell any alcohol beverages while possessing a firearm within 100 yards. It also says manufacture and transport. My client wasn't charged with that. He wasn't charged with that in the indictment. He wasn't charged with that in the bill of particulars. I would suggest that the courts have been a little bit unfair in taking Blackburger to go to the statute and look with what the statute might say when the person is not charged with that. If my client is charged with selling alcoholic beverages under the statute, he's not charged with transporting. He's not charged with manufacturing. He's charged with selling under this statute. Selling while he had a gun within 100 yards. Then he's charged with selling with the same alcohol without a license. But it says unlawfully sell. Unlawfully sell has to include selling without a license. It is an unlawful sale. It made it unlawful. It may have also made it unlawful here that it was moonshine, but it made it unlawful that he didn't have a license. And so it is a lesser included offense. And my client should not be subject to a penalty for both the felony and the misdemeanor selling.
Mr. Berger, let me pick up on your argument. If we're gonna follow your logic, it seems to me consistent with Andrews. You would need to demonstrate from the text of the statute the clarity of the legislative intent to not permit simultaneous punishments, or in the alternative, point us to the legislative history that establishes that. And you've done neither of those things yet. So can you do that? Because it seems to me, unless you can, you've got a problem.
Well, I would suggest that it is not our burden to prove the legislative intent, that there would be a presumption that statutes should be interpreted strictly against the Commonwealth, and that it should be the duty of the Commonwealth to prove that there was specifically that intent. I did cite in my brief to 18.2-53.1.
Well, you're the one that's asserting a double jeopardy bar. Typically, it's your burden of persuasion to establish why that bar exists. It's not the Commonwealth's burden to, you know, automatically negate conceivable.
I recognize the reasonableness of your question. I'm saying that it is.
You just don't have an answer for it.
That it's both sides of the case, but. Unless the legislature in 18.2-53.1 made it very clear that if you use a firearm in the commission of murder, it's a separate offense and you get a separate conviction for that. And there are a number of cases like that. One of the cases, I believe it's dealing with some type of drug, says that prosecution under this section does not prohibit prosecution under another. No, it's drunk driving, aggravated drunk driving manslaughter. That says prosecution under this code section does not prevent prosecution under others' code section.
Well, what,
so the
what
legislature
the,
could give us language there and make it clear that was their intent.
Well, what the Supreme Court did in Andrews was to basically parse the capital murder statute and compare the legislative amendments to the various precedents, various cases the Supreme Court handed down, and noted how they reacted to the law. And so from that could discern what the legislative intent was as to how that was to be punished. And you know, granting your premise that you would do that before you get to any sort of a Blockberger analysis, because it may obviate a Blockberger analysis, you know, it seems to me that exercise would need to be done here.
Point taken. I should have done a better job in being able to answer that question. But I would submit that...
You're in your rebuttal, just so you're aware.
Right. Most of our firearm statutes have been come along lately, statutes that have added on top punishments because they wanted to elevate certain crimes to a felony and provide for a greater punishment. And I would submit that the title of the code section, Violations by Armed Persons Penalty, shows that, and that's the intent here, that a person who is selling alcohol and has a firearm nearby, that it is a greater offense and increases the penalty. And that there is nothing in the wording of the statutes to show that there is any intent for the legislature to say, yeah, we want to punish them for both of these. And that it would be incumbent upon some language in the statute to show that.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. This court is well aware the standard of review for this case is one of de novo review. The challenge arises from the trial court's denial of the motion to dismiss or merge the crimes. And I would contend that the defendant's argument is flawed for failing to view the crimes in the abstract. If I could turn first to the Holly case, though, because it would appear that would set a bar to reaching the analysis if the court subscribed to the argument put forward by defense counsel this morning. And just to clarify for the record, the Holly case is this court's on-bank opinion from 2014, that's 64 Virginia App 156, authored by Judge McCullough. And I would submit that Holly stands for the proposition that this court doesn't engage in a Blockberger analysis if the legislative intent is clear. And under the specific facts of Holly, by tracing the evolution of the homicide statutes, in Holly it's significant that the individual was convicted of felony murder as a first degree and second degree murder. And as the Holly opinion lays out, the intent of the legislature was to lessen the punishment of homicide in common law, to mitigate the punishment, not to make it more severe or put a defendant at greater criminal risk. And so, eyeing the legislative history of the homicide statutes in Virginia, the court said that it's clearly not the intent of the legislature. We don't even need to reach the Blockberger analysis in light of this history. And Judge Humphreys, as your question elucidated, that's simply absent here. There's no analysis of the legislative history related to these alcohol statutes that would obviate the Blockberger analysis.
Well, it seems to me, maybe you can comment on this, in the abstract, for example, and I won't bother to quote the statute verbatim, but you know, one statute penalizes you for not having a license to sell alcohol. Another statute penalizes you for not paying a tax on any alcohol you sell. And the third statute prohibits you from possessing a gun within, you know, 100 yards or whatever it is of an alcohol manufacturing facility, to put it kind, or still, I guess, to put it kindly. So those are obviously analytically different. And I presume that in response to that question I asked Mr. Berger and the comment you just made, that there's no indication facially that the General Assembly would have intended those to all merge together, that basically, you know, not paying the tax, not having a license, and having a gun when you shouldn't is somehow, if you do any one of those things, you're relieved from any legal liability as to any of those other acts that may occur.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would submit the multiplicity of ways in which those statutes may be violated suggests just the opposite, that there was absolutely no legislative intent to merge those statutes. And if I could address the merits, Your Honor, it is no trouble at all to parse those statutes. I spent a great deal of time looking at them, and I would like to talk about them in a little detail. I would say, as an overarching matter, the defendant's argument is flawed in that it looks specifically at these instant facts, that the statutes in this case were violated all through the sale of alcohol. And clearly that's not the appropriate standard in the Blockberger analysis. We must look at them in the abstract. And moreover, unless the statutes always require the proof of the same elements, they are not the same offense. They do not merge. One is not the lesser included offense of the other. And that's made clear by the Schwartz opinion in this court, where a person was charged with murder and malicious wounding. And the court said murder requires a specific intent to kill. Malicious wounding can be done a number of ways with an intent to disfigure, disable, or kill. It doesn't always require the same, so they can't be said to be the same. And so here, 4.1318, which criminalizes the possession of a firearm, can be accomplished in three ways. You can manufacture, you can transport, or you can sell alcoholic beverages while possessing a firearm. And unless all of those must always be the same in the sale of alcohol, they're not the same offense. And even though Mr. Bray happened to be selling alcohol while possessing a weapon, clearly he could have manufactured alcohol, he could have been transporting alcohol.
Well, I think Mr. Berger's, and I won't try to put words in his mouth, but it seems to me his argument boils down to all of these offenses as an element require the sale of alcohol. One, you're doing it without a license, one, you're doing it without paying taxes on it, and the other, you're basically doing it when there's a gun down the road a piece, I guess. And that because it's a single act of selling alcohol, essentially, that should subsume everything. That's his argument. I'm not sure I agree with it, but that's, I think, what you need to respond to in terms of...
I would submit, in light of the jurisprudence in this Commonwealth, that's a flawed argument. And specifically, I would look to Payne. And there's one body, there's one death. But we have two homicide convictions based on different theories, which don't always require the same elements. And so on the strength of this court's opinion in Payne, I would say that argument cannot succeed. It doesn't matter in the specific instance.
Well, of course, the counter-argument to that, and I remember this well because I was the prosecutor in the case, is Claggett versus Commonwealth. The Supreme Court basically said that, you know, you have as many homicides as you have bodies, and no more. So, I mean, that may cut against your argument there a little bit.
And if the court is unwilling to use that specific example, I would submit that the logic is nevertheless as powerful in this instance. It does not matter that Mr. Gray was selling alcohol. What matters is that a conviction under possessing a firearm didn't require the sale in every instance. A conviction that criminalizes possession of untaxed alcohol says nothing about possessing a license to sell alcohol. When one is convicted under 4.1302, it doesn't matter whether the alcohol is lawfully possessed. Your crime is selling it without a license to sell it. We don't care about how the alcohol was made, how you obtained it. You just don't have a license to sell it. And so I would submit that these are different elements. They don't share elements, and they don't always require the same elements. And so I would simply respond to the defendant's argument that it is an in light of the jurisprudence, and he can't prevail upon that. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the panel may have if there are specific areas that I can address.
Hearing none, we thank you very much, sir. Rebuttal, Mr. Berger.
Being an old prosecutor and talking to an old prosecutor this week, he made the statement to me, prosecutors make answer two questions. Can I prosecute, and then should I prosecute? I would suggest that the same thing exists when you put on the road. Can I affirm this decision, and should I affirm this decision? And because what you do is sends out ripples into what happens in the daily lives of courtrooms across the state, and it is important. This case is small in its effect on Ronald Bray, but I would submit that the issue continues to revolve. It is not an issue that we faced 35 years ago, because prosecutors weren't prosecuting cases multiple ways, multiple times. Now,
Mr. Berger, let me interrupt you. I'm an old prosecutor who's now wearing a robe, and I got to tell you, I've been on this court now 15 years, and I shake my head sometimes at the piling on that I see some prosecutors do. I wouldn't have done it in my day. I wish, frankly, in some cases they weren't doing it now. But the point is, they have a certain amount of discretion, and whether I would do it or not is really not the case, not the analysis. I mean, my oath requires me to evaluate whether the law based on the standard review has been upheld or not. And sometimes I have to hold my nose when I write those opinions.
I do respect that. And I understand that. But I believe that there is an opening from Andrews here for the court to look at legislative intent. And as this court looks at the facts in this case, I would submit that there, you know, I doubt the legislature really even thought about this, to be honest with the court. They didn't think about it.
You mean that thing we put in so many opinions that says the legislature is presumed to know what it's doing is not necessarily accurate?
Well,
I'm shocked.
Probably now's a good time to call it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel and thereafter take up the case of Green versus the Commonwealth.